At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
President Trump takes a step toward unwinding Obamacare on his own. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, October 12th. Good to have you with us. After years of promises, months of political back and forth, the Republican Congress tried and failed to repeal Obamacare this year. Today, President Donald Trump took a step toward rolling it back on his own. He signed in an executive order with the intention of letting Americans buy skimpier health insurance policies.
This will create tremendous competition and transformative in so many ways, change aimed at creating more and lower prices for millions of Americans.
For more, we have Sarah Cliff with us. She's the senior policy correspondent at Vox and host of the podcast The Impact. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So President Trump promised today that this executive order is the first step toward lower costs and more health insurance options for millions of Americans. Fact check that, Sarah. True or false?
I think half true. It is certainly true this executive order will give some people lower premiums. These people are young and they are healthy. But for people who are sicker, who are older, who need really robust health insurance plans, this will be the exact opposite. This will lead to higher premiums and more money out of pocket on healthcare.
Explain that to me. Why?
Yeah, so essentially what they're doing or what they want to do with this executive order is let skimpier health insurance plans into the insurance market. And they do this a couple of ways. One is through something called association health plans, which are essentially a bunch of small businesses, maybe individuals. They band together to purchase insurance. A bunch of bakeries, for example, might make a baker's association. And they might only let the healthy young bakers into that association because they want low premiums. And then that kind of leaves the older people in the original insurance market pool with people who are sicker and older as the healthier people go into these other kind of more desirable plans. The same thing is happening with another provision about short-term insurance, which are these plans that last maybe 3 months or so. And again, don't have to follow the Obamacare rules. They don't have to cover pre-existing conditions. They don't have to cover the set of essential benefits. So that's another way of siphoning off younger, healthier people into the plans they want. But that is, you know, very hurtful for the people who need robust benefits and the people who do have pre-existing conditions.
And what exactly does today's order do? It doesn't make these changes immediately, right? Lots of this is future looking.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Adrienne. All of this is going to have to go through a federal rulemaking period. There will be comments. There will be big, long, nitty-gritty rules that spell out what happens. So this will not change the insurance market right away. Most insurance companies don't expect 2018 to be much different. It's really 2019 where we're looking at some possibly big changes.
What options do Democrats and other supporters of the ACA have here? Where's this fight going to go next?
I think it goes to the courts and whether the Trump administration has the authority to make these sort of changes. So you can certainly expect as this executive order comes out, as rules start being made, that those who support the Affordable Care Act will say, wait a minute, this isn't allowed. You're not allowed to skirt the Obamacare rules. this way. So I think you certainly see a legal battle shaping up quite quickly over this new executive order.
And will there be political battles as well? What are the political implications of this for both parties?
Definitely. So I think you will see, and you're already seeing President Trump talking about this as lowering premiums, getting rid of costly Obamacare mandates. They are going to focus on that side. And it will be true for some people that there are lower premiums in the insurance market. But you can expect the Democrats to have a lot of the messaging they had about Obamacare repeal to dust that off and start using it again about how this will let insurance companies discriminate against pre-existing conditions, that, you know, moms might not be able to buy maternity care. Someone with cancer or asthma might not be able to get some of these insurance policies. So it really will be another version of the Obamacare repeal fight we've had all year, the same sort of rhetoric, just in a new setting over this executive order.
Sarah Cliff is senior policy correspondent at Vox and host of the new podcast, The Impact. Thanks as always, Sarah.
Thank you.
A flash of red from the markets today, but just a flash. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Fires continue to rage in Northern California. At least 24 people have been killed. Hundreds more are missing. Thousands of homes and businesses have burned. These fires are among the worst in California's history. Across the state, there are about 8,000 firefighters pushing back against the flames. Marketplace sustainability reporter Jeg Kim looks at how massive firefights are staffed.
With massive fires in Northern and Southern California, crews are stretched thin. Help has come from elsewhere, says Randy Eardley. He's a spokesman for the National Interagency Fire Center, and he points out that fire season is over in other areas. There aren't as many seasonal workers on hand.
A lot of them have been laid off in other states. We do, however, have access to a lot of resources that are still on board.
Those resources include dozens of borrowed engines and air tankers. California's also directly asked for help from its neighbors. Scott Vail is a deputy fire chief for California's Office of Emergency Services. He says engines from Oregon and Arizona are a welcome sight.
We'll be able to restock and replenish and get some rest and be able to put some well-rested firefighters back on the fire line.
But hiring and training more full-time firefighters isn't happening fast enough, says Michael Taylor. He researches fire economics at the University of Nevada, Reno.
There's a growing recognition as the fire season get longer, they need more full-time firefighters. And I think the agency's budgets just haven't caught up to this reality.
Mike Lopez agrees. He's with a union that represents California firefighters. Even with the recent historic drought and intense fire seasons, he says,
in those 6 years, Cal Fire has only added 5 engine companies. 5.
Still, Lopez says, little could have been done to prepare for these fires. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
The stock market has surged for much of the year, and President Trump, like all presidents, wants to take credit. But last night, he took it a step further and suggested the stock market can help fix the country's debt problem, which got a lot of people scratching their heads. Marketplace's Scott Tong checks it out.
Last night on Fox News, the president said the nation's debt grew during the past administration.
They borrowed more than $10 trillion, right? And yet we picked up $5.2 trillion just in the stock market, possibly picked up the whole thing in terms of the first 9 months in terms of value. So you could say in one sense, we're really increasing values and maybe in a sense, we're reducing debt.
Really? For this, we reached two professors who actually teach Econ 101. Stephen Kyle at Cornell says stocks and the nation's debt are entirely different assets. To explain this in class, he draws pictures.
I draw a picture of a building that's the Treasury and then draw pictures of factories that are corporations.
The Treasury debt is the IOUs the government owes. They're bonds. Stocks are ownership of private companies. But wait, can you argue that stocks rise, people get richer, they pay more taxes, and the feds pay off debt?
In some small way, and I would underline small, it could help.
Not in a way that suggests there's some dollar-for-dollar relationship.
Oh, God, no, not anywhere even close to that.
Okay, how about this? The bull market can show that a good economy has replaced a bad economy with rising debt. The problem is that's not the case, says Justin Wolfers, Econ 101, University of Michigan.
The stock market has been rising over the past few months, no faster than Europe, for instance, and the national debt is rising.
Rising because federal spending exceeds the taxes coming in. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Predicting flood risk is a science. Science that gets translated into flood maps. And those maps define the floodplain. They help determine who has to buy flood insurance and who doesn't. But in Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, many homes that were not marked as risky on those federal flood maps did in fact flood, which has got people asking why. Why were those properties not included in the danger zone? Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth reports.
When the record rains in Hurricane Harvey spilled out beyond Houston's floodplain, it wasn't the first time.
Very heavy rain is falling from inside the loop, inside the belt, to the south of Houston, especially to the southeast of Houston.
You're not going to believe this, but this is Highway 225. Look at this guy trying to make it. Look.
That's local TV news from Tropical Storm Allison 16 years ago.
After we had Tropical Storm Allison in 2001, there was a big project to update all of the city's maps.
Jamila Johnson is floodplain manager for the city of Houston.
That was a long process to get through the science of all of it and make sure that both the engineering community and the public can come to an understanding.
That last part is important, making sure the engineers and the public come to an understanding. See, flood maps are not just about science. That 2007 revision was negotiated over 6 years. It drew the lines that Harvey erased last month. Roughly half the land that flooded in Harvey was outside the floodplain. Sarah Prowley is a professor at Syracuse University who's studying flood maps. She says there are many problems with how we draw them.
The maps are based on historical data. They're static maps. They don't take into account future development scenarios and future weather-related scenarios having to do with climate change.
Predictive maps that look ahead and factor in climate change could be more accurate, Prowley says. But they'd also bring more properties into the floodplain. She says communities resist this.
In many of my interviews, that was something that people complained about a lot, is that communities didn't always seem that eager to look forward. They even hinted that some communities were trying to suppress that information.
Because of its negative effect on development and property values. Which brings up another problem in her eyes. If a community doesn't like FEMA's maps, it can appeal them. Diana Herrera is an insurance specialist at FEMA, and to her, that right to appeal means transparency.
When we start a mapping process, the communities are with us from day one.
When a community appeals a map, usually because it doesn't want the floodplain expanded, she says it has to be on a scientific basis.
Engineering is going to have to be submitted to us to determine that our numbers were wrong.
The problem is that you can pretty much buy the results you want. Engineers with better funding than FEMA can use more advanced technology and thus can lobby via science for maps that local authorities might prefer.
How much political negotiation goes into some of these maps?
Politics we try and keep out as much as we can.
But she says it happens. Representatives in Congress, for example, will ask FEMA to consider these other private studies. Rachel Carr runs a nonprofit, the Nurture Nature Center.
It's a science-based community center with a focus on flooding issues.
She says FEMA's maps should be the bare minimum. Communities need to order their own forward-looking flood maps to plan around their real risk, even if it means lower property values or higher insurance.
How likely are most flood-risk communities to do this themselves?
To be really optimistic.
She says Allison, Katrina, Sandy, those storms didn't bring the reforms needed. But maybe the high costs of Harvey, Irma, and Maria will. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
coming up?
I didn't cook, but now I do, and so I would want a cookbook for someone like me who is afraid to admit that they don't know how to clean up their kitchen.
I feel your pain. Who likes cleaning? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 0.1%, 31 points, to close at 22,841. The NASDAQ lost 0.1%, 12 points, to finish at 6,591. And the S&P 500 also shed 0.1%, 4 points, ending at 2,550. As we told you up earlier in the show, President Trump has signed an executive order to do what the GOP couldn't, chip away parts of the Affordable Care Act. On the news, Anthem, one of the nation's largest health insurers, was down less than 0.1%. Aetna lost 1.1%, and United Health Group fell 1.1%. Bonds rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. College textbooks are notoriously expensive. A new copy of the 8th edition of Principles of Economics, to use an example fitting to our show, will run you more than $200. Braille textbooks for blind students are significantly more expensive. Translating a textbook into Braille can cost thousands of dollars. A reprint costs hundreds. And many textbooks aren't available in Braille at all. Now, a major Braille book publisher is working to make higher-level course materials more accessible. WABE's Tasneem Shama reports.
Here's how blind student Kyla Weathers describes her first semester of college back in 2010.
I didn't do terribly, like I didn't flunk out or anything.
During her time at Dalton State College in North Georgia, she used workarounds. She had a professional scribe sit next to her during exams to transcribe her Braille answers to the Roman alphabet. And she got most of her college textbooks in a hard copy Braille format.
It's kind of funny. I tell people that I'm a visual learner, even though I've been totally blind my entire life. But to really understand something, especially academically, I would prefer to read it and have it under my fingers because I feel like it sticks in my head better.
She went on to become the first fully blind student to graduate from Dalton State last year. And since universities are not required to collect information about students with disabilities and the type of disabilities they have, it's hard to quantify how many students may need vision-related services. But the American Foundation for the Blind estimates there are about 245,000 college students who are blind or visually impaired nationwide. Many of their schools send requests for Braille transcription to Georgia Tech's Accessibility Solutions and Research Center, or AMAC, which has a printing press. Guy Tolles heads AMAC's Braille Services Department. It's one of the only centers in the country focused on college textbooks, especially science, technology, engineering, and math.
Those subjects require advanced codes, the need to see things in a spatial arrangement, but then also the maps, charts, diagrams, and figures that have to be recreated in order for the Braille reader to feel and understand a concept.
In a biochemistry textbook, diagrams of molecules look like a collage art project. Strings of yarn and strips of paper are embedded amidst the Braille. And because Braille takes up more physical space...
You know, a math book may be 1,000 pages. Well, it may be 5,000 Braille pages.
So they're heavy and more expensive than your average college textbook. Converting just 5 chapters of a science book into Braille can cost up to $15,000. But Braille reprints go for about $500.
the types of subjects that I see students who are blind or vision impaired enrolled in now, from an aeronautical school to, you know, some of the highest levels of math, computer coding. And I think that's a sign that, you know, equal access is only going to improve.
There are 8 people at AMAC dedicated to Braille transcription services, but most of the transcription work is produced by an unlikely group of outside contractors, prisoners and ex-convicts. Becky Snyder is with the American Printing House for the Blind's National Prison Braille Network in Louisville, Kentucky. Her group helps teach inmates how to read and transcribe Braille materials. She says prisoners tell her,
"There's a child out there in a classroom who now is able to participate fully in a classroom because of something that I'm doing."
And she says it gives prisoners a practical skill and benefits them in other ways.
"I think it raises self-esteem and gives people a great sense of purpose."
The prison Braille program has doubled over the last decade, expanding to more than 30 states. In Atlanta, I'm Tasneem Shamma for Marketplace.
There are a whole lot of people out there entering grown-uphood without ever having learned their way around a kitchen. Enter the new cookbook, Hot Mess Kitchen, Recipes for Your Delicious, Disastrous Life. Authors Miranda Berman and Gabby Moskowitz set out to turn reluctant millennials into home chefs. Gabby is the experienced food writer of the two. She spent years creating low-cost recipes for frugal cooks. I met up with both in Miranda's kitchen here in Los Angeles, where Gabby was cooking up some rice. And she talked us through the plan for the rest of our meal, starting with a can of beans.
And then these are just going to get opened and rinsed and heated up. And then we're going to get going on some chicken breast and then a few little toppings.
Miranda is a comedy writer. The cookbook is filled with her jokes, stories, and with recipes with names like Bounce Check Burrito and Quarter Life Crisis Queso. But she was also getting her hands dirty.
And what are you doing with the chicken over there?
Just putting salt and pepper on it.
Just massaging it.
Just massaging it for fun.
Hand fry the chicken, cut it up, layer it on top of the rice with those beans, some hot sauce, sour cream, avocado.
This is Someday I'll Be Rich rice and beans.
Why did you guys start your cookbook with this recipe and the Broke AF chapter? Why was that where you started?
Well, so when we start talking about what being a hot mess means and what our readers are going to want and going to need and what we think is important, I mean, cost was such a big part of that. And so this recipe is the quintessential, inexpensive, filling meal. You can switch up the beans, you can switch up the vegetables, the toppings, whatever. It's very customizable, and it's a great sort of, look how quickly this comes together. Look how easy this is. Maybe cooking isn't so scary kind of recipe.
And what about this idea about writing a cookbook for people who don't cook? That's something else that struck me as a challenge here, is how do you get people to actually use their kitchen?
Well, I think making it funny so that they pick it up is one thing. And also appealing to sort of a specific audience that really can use cooking, even if they don't already.
There are enough books out there for people who love cooking. And I don't feel that our skills are necessary in that boat. Like, they already exist.
Right.
And the other thing is that I didn't cook, but now I do. And so I would want a cookbook for someone like me who is afraid to admit that they don't know how to clean up their kitchen, but like wants someone to help them. So we want to be there holding your hand and saying it's fine.
So when you were thinking about all the recipes that you've cooked, all the recipes you might want to cook, what did a recipe need to have to make it into this book?
So it either had to have a direct connection to a story and be something that our readers and we would actually want to make, but it also needed to be something that wasn't too expensive and that had ingredients that were accessible and easy to find and with a process that was straightforward and easy to do.
What are your personal hopes for this cookbook? What do you guys want to get out of it?
We'd love a television show.
You need two. I need two of them.
But I think on sort of like a mission level, our generation, and I'm a few years older than Miranda, but I love to say that it's that we share a generation.
We do.
So many of us grew up with both parents out of the house and therefore eating convenience foods, not really learning how to cook. And then we went out into the world with no domestic skills. And I feel really strongly that learning to cook is one of the best ways to be healthier, to be financially healthier. There are a lot of funny cookbooks out there that don't have great recipes. Mm-hmm. And it was really important to us that the recipes be great because as funny as the book is and as much fun as it is, I want readers at the end of the day to feel like I can make the stuff in there and it's going to make me feel better and it's going to be tasty and easy and fun.
So it's a book you actually want people to use.
We really want people to use it.
Yes, that is definitely like the, I don't want somebody to just pick it up and be like, oh, this is cute. I want them to say, oh, I was in this situation. Like I recognize this funny title and it applies to my life. And so I'm going to make this. It's like a call to action. I can cook because this is telling me what to do in this exact moment. And it's not that hard.
That was Miranda Berman and Gabby Moskowitz. Oh, and those Someday I'll Be Rich rice and beans. Can we taste this beautiful
nice
rice and bean bowl?
Yeah.
Should we all go together at the same time so nobody's germs are
and I'm
going to
take
prevalent
the dirtiest fork. So that
I'll take the second dirtiest. Yeah, it was good. This final note before we go today. President Trump took to Twitter to criticize Puerto Rico. I quote here, "Electric and all infrastructure was disaster before hurricanes," he wrote. "We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders in Puerto Rico, quote, forever," he tweeted. Let's take a step back here. Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, which is part of the U.S., only about 3 weeks ago. FEMA is still, and we checked this today, helping out in New York and New Jersey after Sandy hit back in 2012. And FEMA is still in Louisiana, helping after Katrina, which made landfall more than 12 years ago. Today, the Dow shed 0.1%, 31 points to close at 22,841. The Nasdaq lost 0.1%, 12 points to finish at 6,591. And the S&P 500 also shed 0.1%, ending at 2,550. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.